Well, what an exciting time to come back and kick off ASCO. It's wonderful to start this year's ASCO with research to practice. There's a lot of lung data to discuss. There is much more discussion to have about what's going on, and the lung space has really become quite a bit more complicated, and I think in the short time ahead is going to get further complicated, which is exciting because it represents progress. Welcome, everybody, to Data and Perspectives: Clinical Investigators Discuss the Current and Future Role of Immunotherapy and Antibody-Drug Conjugates in Lung Cancer. I'm Dr. Jacob Sands, and I'm very happy to be here to moderate this session today. We have an unbelievable panel with Dr. Solange Peters from Lausanne University Hospital, Dr. Marina Garasino, local University of Chicago, had a long trip in, Dr. John Heymach from the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center. And I believe this is some disclosures that I'll click through, but feel free to go back and look closer at these. We do have Dr. Love's disclosures on here. And this is the commercial support for today. Also, to just mention, Research to Practice CME Planning Committee staff and reviewers have no COIs to disclose. The program will contain discussion of non-approved uses of various agents and regimens. Please refer to the official prescribing information for each product for approved indications. So this kicks off the session today. We will start with a presentation from Dr. Peters about immune checkpoint inhibitors in non-small cell lung cancer. Then Dr. Garasino will talk about targeted and other novel strategies for relapsed, second-line and beyond metastatic non-small cell. I will discuss antibody-drug conjugates, specifically TROP2 ADCs in advanced non-small cell lung cancer. And then Dr. Heymach will discuss immune checkpoint inhibitors in the non-metastatic setting. And with that, I will pass it off to Dr. Peters.
Thanks so much. A great pleasure to take like 10 minutes to discuss with you the current role of immune checkpoint inhibitors in the frontline setting of the treatment of metastatic non-small cell lung cancer. These tumors which do not harbor what we call an AGA, an actionable genomic alteration. So just to settle where we come from, remember that the old days of chemotherapy, which defined the beginning of my career, were about 8 months of median overall survival and virtually no long-term survivorship, with a 5-year overall survival in metastatic lung cancer of 0% across all TNM classification. And we start from that 8 months median OS, no long-term survivors, to look at all the new options we might have. So first of all, we have been classifying our tumors by PD-L1 expression, as defined on their expression, its expression on the tumor cells, with the high expressor potentially benefiting from a simple immune checkpoint inhibitor monotherapy. So this is what we have as being comparing an immune checkpoint, anti-PD-1 or anti-PD-L1, namely pembrolizumab, atezolizumab, and cemiplimab, versus chemotherapy in the frontline setting of this patient with more than 50% of the tumor cells expressing PD-L1. So this is what we have, meaning, and to make a long story short, a benefit in PFS and a benefit in overall survival versus chemotherapy. And on the right-hand side, I always like to show that we have the ESMO magnitude of clinical benefit scale, meaning the quantification of the benefit of a new enterprise, a new initiative, a new treatment strategy, which in the palliative setting goes from 1 to 5. 5 is a maximum. And in the curative setting, goes from C to A. And what we define in ESMO, when you have a tail of the curve, a plateau, meaning that you impact long-term survival. So you transform palliation into cure. You can classify your strategy from A to C instead of 1 to 5. And as you can see here, the KEYNOTE-024 with pembrolizumab and this long-term benefit, one patient out of three still alive at 5 years and beyond, makes it an A and a five. The A was added recently, right? The 5-year survival, as you can see here, for pembrolizumab is 32%. And we know that for EMPOWER-Lung1 with cemiplimab is 29%. So we start from zero. It's absolutely amazing. And the A will be granted, of course, later on to cemiplimab too. These are the curves. So you can really see the upper is PFS, overall survival. These benefits reproduced. There might be a loss in the benefits at the long-term result beyond the statistical planned analysis of atezolizumab in the middle, but it's also because the scoring system for PD-L1 was a bit more complex, a bit more blurring the picture. But basically, these data are superimposable. What is very important to keep in mind is it's a continuum. The more, the best. The more you have PD-L1 expression, the best. On the left side, the main U.S. Centers Initiative qualifying that more than 90% is better than more than 50. And on the right-hand side, in the cemiplimab trial, you had all of this strata of expression being proportionally, correlated with a better overall survival and PFS. A word of caution doing that. So this is the OS curve and PFS curve of pembrolizumab versus chemo. Is that at the first CT scan, you do the very first CT scan, a third of the patients progress. So despite the wonderful result, your patient must be able to afford a progression and not having a threatening disease. And last but not least, in this trial, what was very disappointing is the level of second-line treatment. Half of the patient got a second line, so you get pembro and then nothing. So really pay attention to the follow-up of the patient. They still haven't received chemo if they receive checkpoint first. So if the other patients who don't have high PD-L1, meaning that they have 0 to 49% expression of PD-L1, there's an unmet need, which is about combining chemo and a checkpoint versus the old-days chemotherapy. This is a table in non-squamous non-small cell lung cancer using various checkpoints, anti-PD-1, anti-PD-L1 with chemo, improving PFS and overall survival. These are only positive trials. You can see an A4 for the pembrolizumab trial already, so considered as potentially curative, with a 5-year survival of 19.4 months. This table is only for non-squamous non-small cell lung cancer. If you look at the same table for squamous, you again have a series of positive PFS and OS trial, checkpoint plus chemo versus chemo, and again an A4 for the pembrolizumab initiative, with a 5-year survival quite comparable in squamous versus non-squamous of 18%, so very close to what we had with non-squamous. Is chemotherapy needed, therefore, when you have high PD-L1 more than 50%? We don't have prospective data at the time being. We just have retrospective real-world data. We did it with the ETOP group and the Flatiron database. And to make a long story short, in general, across big patient subgroup, the chemo is not needed regardless of liver metastasis, regardless of brain metastasis, with one exception, the never smokers need chemotherapy with a hazard ratio of 0.25. So basically, remember my word of caution, but taking this into account, chemo might not be needed. Let's look, by the way, at outcomes according to PD-L1 subgroup, because I would like you to pay attention to one subgroup. If you look at this strata, it's very small for me. So there's one subgroup not really benefiting from the chemo IO versus chemo is a negative PD-L1 subgroup. Here, the hazard ratio for overall survival is 1. So it doesn't work so much. And that's why the EMA, our regulators, said that semiplimab plus chemo can be used, but only in positive PD-L1s because of that data. So that's a limitation you have to keep in mind. If a benefit there is in a negative PD-L1, it's very small and modest. So how can we potentially overcome that? So we have a series of trials with not only a checkpoint PD-1, PD-L1, but adding on the top a CTLA-4 inhibitor. One trial without chemo, the CheckMate 227, complex trial, many changes of endpoints. A trial with tremelimumab and durvalumab plus chemo. There is, interestingly, a second arm with durva plus chemo, allowing you to have the component of CTLA-4 to be deciphered from the rest. And the last but not least, 9LA, which is 2 cycles of chemo, ipi-nivo versus chemo. So all this role of CTLA-4. So why is CTLA-4? First of all, because from melanoma to lung cancer, renal cancer, what you have been showing is an enlargement, a broader repertoire of various T-cell clones when you give a CTLA-4. The visibility of your neoantigens is improved by the fact that you have a CTLA-4. And this results in all of this trial, like before, as compared to platinum doublet, a benefit in PFS, benefit in OS in all of these trials. But you will tell me, it's not so much better than what you have shown before without the CTLA-4. So why would you use the CTLA-4 with all the toxicity? The curves look the same. So that's what I'd like to stress. This is about the negative PD-L1. Remember hazard ratio of 1 when you go with chemo and a checkpoint. And here, when you add a CTLA-4, suddenly in the 227, in the 9LA, and in the Poseidon trial, your hazard ratio becomes again, like in the ITT population, it becomes again 0.7, roughly 0.7 in the negative PD-L1. So you recover this third of patients who suffer from a tumor which is characterized with a negative PD-L1. And what I like in Poseidon is you can really showcase the role of tremelimumab because there's one arm without, remember. So here the survival is 1, the hazard ratio of survival is 1 when you don't have the CTLA-4 and 0.8 when you add the CTLA-4. So you have the switch on the left showing you this isolation of the clear blue arm. Tremelimumab helps these negative PD-L1 patients. Okay? Other subgroups why you would potentially consider CTLA-4. So this is the work of MD Anderson, John Haymack, and Skoulidis mainly, but we have been showing over time that STK11 mutation, like KEAP1, are characterizing, I would say, an immune desert with a recruitment of myeloid-derived suppressor cell, with a repression of the important STING pathway, as well as a low CD3, a low PD-L1-2. So really tumors which are not prone to immunotherapy, and even explaining the mechanism, we have been isolating the fact that these patients with STK11 KEAP1 might benefit from a CTLA-4. We have been showing it in the trials. This is Poseidon, where you can recover against this subgroup for the efficacy of immunotherapy, which is not seen with a monotherapy checkpoint in 9LA, in 227, and this is in Poseidon, right? STK11 on the left, KRAS on the right. And there is an ongoing trial trying to isolate STK11, KRAS, KEAP1, and prove the benefit of CTLA-4 to be added in this Triton trial. Last but not least, melanoma patients, melanoma colleagues have all been discussing for a while that brain tumors, and we don't really explain why, might benefit from a CTLA-4 in the way it probably modulates the tumor microenvironment. And in melanoma, no problem. When you have brain mets, you receive a CTLA-4. Is it right for lung cancer? We still don't know, but the magnitude, the incremental of benefit we've been seeing with CTLA-4 in all of these trials, on the left patient with brainline brain mets, on the right without, you can see how much you can create a difference with a hazard ratio of 0.45 when you add a CTLA-4, suggests we have the same in lung cancer. This is just about the two trial with nivolumab and ipilimumab. You can see how this incremental of benefit can be depicted by a movement of the hazard ratio on the left to an additional difference as compared to chemo when you have the CTLA-4, but no prospective data. So this is a summary table. I have added on the bottom the CTLA-4, non-squamous, where you have now 5-year survival, roughly of 20% across all of these subgroups with or without a CTLA-4, but using immunotherapy. And the squamous, with something a little lower, but still very interesting, around 18% of survival at 5 years. We started from 0, remember. So this is the ESMO guidelines. So you have on the left monotherapy in high PD-L1, and on the right you have all the potential combination in all strata of PD-L1. I just would like to bring my nuance. Potentially not use monotherapy in never smokers or in STK11 and KEAP1. And maybe think about the CTLA-4 in negative PD-L1, in brain metastasis, and in the STK11 and KEAP1. And my colleague will describe and discuss again, and at this ASCO meeting, you will see a lot about this new field of bispecific. Will it further improve what we do alone or combined with chemotherapy? And I invite you to go. This educational book of ASCO is amazing. And you have this article reviewing the bispecific antibodies in non-small cell lung cancer, a source of inspiration. Just go through that. You will know everything about the data today. And with this, I thank you for your kind attention.
Excellent. That has become an increasingly complicated discussion. Now, first line used to just be one or two different studies. Now there's a lot to discuss. So let's start with a case in this, and this is somewhat surface level. 69-year-old guy experienced worsening shortness of breath. Now he had kind of a complicated course before ultimately ending up inpatient with a complicated outpatient scenario where his symptoms were really getting worse. He came into the hospital with quite a bit of shortness of breath, ended up seeing cardiology and pulmonology inpatient as well. And ended up with a scan that showed really multiple nodules throughout both lungs, pleural effusion, pericardial effusion. Pericardial effusion inpatient, ended up showing a lung adenocarcinoma. No actionable genomic alterations, PD-L1 of 20%. Now, we'll get to it in a moment, but I treated him with carbo-pem-pembro. This was some years ago. And now, that being said, we do have multiple different treatment options in the first-line setting. So, Solange, what do you think of first-line, PD-L1 20%, very symptomatic? Let's say it's outpatient, so we don't complicate inpatient dynamics as far as treatment. But what would you generally think to start with, and what do you think of as being very reasonable options that you might favor for one reason or another?
I would agree with you. I think the reasonable option in this patient, I don't think that just seeing the case like that, the reason to do differently or more than a 189 or a chemo, a checkpoint, chemo PD-1, chemo PD-L1 frontline strategy to start quite fast if possible. The questions I would have here for you to maybe add a CTLA-4 would be to make sure that he doesn't have brain mets. You didn't quote it. Brain mets would push me to add a CTLA-4. And I like in my NGS panel, which excluded EGFR, ALCROSS, and so on, I'd like to see the STK11 to know if it is altered or if it is wild type, because this would be another argument with KEAP1, of course, to potentially add a CTLA-4. But imagining and all of these are negative, I would have done the same thing as you've been doing, right? Doing a chemo checkpoint is very reasonable, hoping that it's going to act fast enough.
So what about in the setting of PD-L1 of 60%? How would that change it? And then again, also to speak to the brain mets and where you might include CTLA-4 in that setting too.
This patient, as you describe him, you know, with this pericardial effusion, this is, for me, it's the example I always give. If there's one scenario in which I cannot afford the third of patient progressing at the first CT scan, is spinal cord compression, pericardial effusion. So all of these diseases where you know it's that the risk, you only have one line, only one. So if you have one line, you give the chemo with IO to start, right? So for this patient, even with 90% PD-L1, I think I would have given chemo IO.
John, any thoughts?
Yeah, well, so first of all, I think Solange laid out beautifully cases where I think we have good evidence to support CTLA-4. So brain mets, PD-L1 negative, STK11 and KEAP is a good starting point. This patient doesn't fit any of those. I think the second dimension I think about is, do they need chemo, yes or no? And so you gave the example of a PD-L1 greater than 60%. Now, greater than 50%, that's one of the few cases where we have direct data of pembro with or without IPI, where in the PD-L1 greater than 50%, there was no benefit for adding CTLA-4. So in addition to Solange's data, I would cross off CTLA-4 in the greater than 50%. And for people who are symptomatic, I usually do want to add chemo. So I come to the same conclusion, chemo PD-1 is a reasonable choice. The last caveat I'd add is KRAS itself seems to get a little more benefit from CTLA-4, but if the PD-L1 is greater than 50%, I wouldn't use it.
Okay, interesting. So we've highlighted some subgroups that CTLA-4 might be better in, but PD-L1 greater than 50%, don't account for those. Agreed. Okay. Marina, are there scenarios where the PD-L1 is less than 50% that you might consider checkpoint inhibitor alone?
I think that for those patients, the old patient with a low performance status, maybe based on the data of atezolizumab, there can be some benefit of all the patients who do not tolerate the chemotherapy. Maybe they are candidate for a single agent with a performance status 2.
We published it's the Ipsos trial with Ming Li from London. It's interesting. It was conducted in two PS patients, PS 2 and 3, or elderly patients more than 70 years old with comorbidities of importance. So really the patient you see and you say, platinum doublet will not be a good option. You really kind of, you know, the art of oncology, you see that. And in this patient, atezolizumab is better than monotherapy, gemcitabine, vinorelbine, or any of this equivalent chemo. So I think it's important to keep it in mind because more and more we see these elderly patients with renal insufficiency, sometimes dialysis. So here, IO monotherapy might be an option, regardless of PD-L1.
Yeah. All right, so sounds like more performance status issues, someone that you think may not tolerate the chemotherapy as a reason for that. All right, you can see here the scans. This is before treatment. As I mentioned, he did get first-line carbo-pembro, had about 10 months of disease control on this, full recovery of symptoms, functional status, back to work, and a bit of foreshadowing for a later discussion here in second line. He did end up going on a clinical trial with DS-1062, now called datopotamab deruxtecan, which he tolerated quite well, and we may come back to this discussion at a later time point. Here is a scan of showing an area of improvement on trial. He did have about 21 months of disease control on Dato-DXd. All right, we've addressed these initial questions, so let's move on to another one. So the flip side, I think we've touched on this a bit, the flip side to the PD-L1 less than 50% with immunotherapy alone, PD-L1 greater than 50%, where you may add in the chemotherapy. I think, Solange, you mentioned patients with the pericardial effusion or particular symptoms. Is there anything that to expand on that, or is it really more symptom-driven?
Yeah, and never smokers. Again, remember in all this meta-analysis or data analysis, the never smokers, because in every trial, if you exclude the oncogene addiction, you still continue to see 10% of patients who are never smokers. And this patient need chemo because the neoantigen load might be very low.
Yeah. How about someone who has progressed on chemo, immuno, or immuno alone, where you have a single site of progression? That can be anywhere. Marina, what are your thoughts on that? How are you managing that? I see a lot of variation in how that's managed.
Yeah, we have a strong radiation oncology team, so we consider always a local approach, and we continue the immune checkpoint inhibitors. I think there are also data that maybe you can also re-challenge the chemotherapy if you are in the later part of the immune checkpoint inhibitors. There are the data of cemiplimab. But in general, if it is a single station, we try to do a local treatment.
Yeah. Okay, so let's go on to the next one. So the immune checkpoint bispecific antibodies, are these, John, are these going to replace our PD-1, PD-L1 antibodies? What are you anticipating?
Yeah, so the jury's obviously out. We were awaiting randomized data. My guess at the end of the day is that they're not going to replace PD-1 inhibitors, or at least the PD-1 CTLA-4 for everyone, if we focus on the CTLA-4 there, because I think we clearly see not everybody needs CTLA-4, but there are clearly subgroups that get a major benefit. Now, I think the VEGF PD-1 bispecifics are really interesting to see in light of, we've heard today about the Harmony results that are publicly announced there, and the earlier results with the Harmony 2 study were head-to-head against pembrolizumab in the PD-L1 greater than 1%. It beat it by a considerable margin. The hazard ratio was in the high 0.4s. We don't know the OS data for that yet. So I do think, and I should add here, we know that VEGF is immunosuppressive. We know VEGF can also drive, tumor growth. So it's a rational combination. So I think that I'm pretty enthusiastic that PD-1 VEGF bispecifics are going to end up playing a broader role. I suspect PD-1 CTLA-4 could play a role, but that's probably going to be in specific subgroups, as Solange highlighted.
Solange, you've mentioned quite a bit about the value of adding in CTLA-4 inhibitors, bispecifics with CTLA-4. What are you anticipating about these, and what are you enthusiastic about, whether it be that combination or any others?
There's a mystery here, as I'm sure John tried to solve it when he had to discuss this data, is why would a bispecific work better than the drug A plus the drug B? And there must be something about the microenvironment collaboration of various immune cells plus the cancer cells, which might together give a better occupancy of the receptors, target receptors, but also potentially a more favorable interaction between cells and microenvironment for the immune response to happen. So we all hope they would perform better being bispecifics than A plus B. The preclinical data with CTLA-4 were showing it. We are even thinking that maybe the toxicity will be lower. Not so sure about the toxicity today, but maybe the collaborative way of inhibiting the immune phase of, I would say, construction of the immune response or the effector phase might be more efficient. So let's hope it's going to be more efficacious. At least I'm not sure it's going to be less toxic. Same thing for the VEGF, right? A local collaboration of the immune cells participating in the principles of a coordinated immune response.
And Marina, any particular ongoing trials that you're really interested in?
So there are also the bispecifics targeting TIGIT that I think are of interest. I think that they also, if TIGIT had all these problems that we have seen, maybe targeting with a bispecific, this could become an interesting target again.
All right, and then maybe one last mention. So, John, you mentioned STK11 and maybe KEAP1 we could add in there. Do you recommend everybody be getting that testing, and should that influence decision-making with current clinical standards?
Yeah, I think the key thing to say, we have choices among multiple FDA-approved effective regimens, right? So we have some with CTLA-4 and without CTLA-4. So the first statement is a clinician has choices among multiple effective FDA-approved regimens. If you're looking for data to support that choice, I think the STK11 and KEAP data, as well as the PD-L1 negative data overall, it has shows consistency across multiple studies. So this isn't a single retrospective analysis in one study. We really see across multiple different retrospective data sets. First of all, that the STK11 and KEAP get much less benefit from PD-1 based combinations. And I think that's been shown in at least 7 or 8 different cohorts. Secondly, that they seem to get more relative benefit from CTLA-4. And that's been, I think, shown convincingly, at least in 2 different cohorts. So, among FDA-approved regimens, I think it's a reasonable reason to choose a CTLA-4-containing regimen like Poseidon or potentially 9LA.
Okay, well, with that, let's jump into Dr. Garasino's discussion.
Okay, so 10 minutes to go. Very dense field. We have HER2 and c-MET that are 2 potential new targets, also if they are not actionable alteration by themselves. HER2 was already tested in multiple trials with tyrosine kinase inhibitors, but we have seen the best results very recently with trastuzumab deruxtecan and also with new TKIs. Trastuzumab deruxtecan is an antibody drug conjugate with one part that is an antibody targeting HER2, and then there is a payload and a linker with deruxtecan. The results that we have seen so far are, first, there is the HER2 overexpressing, which is not HER2 mutations, and HER2 mutations, which is a true target and is an actionable alteration. We have seen the first results. You see that there is a response rate of 44.9%, with a median duration of response in the overall population of 10.6 months. And you see the waterfall plot with a very good reduction of the tumor and only very few patients not responding to the drug. This is again the toxicity. You see that in 91% of the patients there is some toxicity, and of note, one of the most important toxicity is the ILD that you can see in 27.5% of the patients, and in 17% of the patients can be a grade 2 toxicity. So it's important to be aware of this toxicity and to check the CT scan, the shortness of breath of the patients, and hold the treatment or start the steroids if the toxicity is high. This is the DESTINY-Lung02. This is a randomization between 2 different doses, 5.4 and 6.4, to see if we could limit the toxicity of this drug. And you can see that both the two doses achieve a very similar progression-free survival and a very similar overall survival. And again, the response rate is 51%. So the recommended dose is 5.4 milligrams per kilogram. Again, here you can see in the waterfall plot that the benefit goes across all the subgroups, and in particular is seen regardless of HER2 mutation type, HER2 amplification status, and also regardless of the number or type of prior therapies. And I want to remember that in this trial, the majority of the patients were highly pretreated. Again, toxicity is again the ILD, and in the majority of the patients there is a related toxicity to the treatment that is in the majority of cases is neutropenia, but again be very careful with the ILD. And you see that with the lower dose, 5.4, there is only 12.9% of ILD compared to 28% with the previous dose of 6.4. This is another trial. You see that there are multiple cohorts. There is the cohort of HER2 mutants. And what it is important here is that we always ask if there is penetration in the brain of this kind of drugs. And you see here that there is penetration in the brain also at the dose of 5.4. And you see that the majority of the patients responded to the treatment, and in particular, I think it's important that they were also pretreated before. This is the Destining Lung-03, and this is in patients pretreated, not with the HER2 mutations, but with the HER2 overexpressing non-small cell lung cancer. And the results were recently presented in the last World Lung Cancer Conference, where you can see that there is an impressive response rate of 44.4%. And you see also that the benefit is either in the HER2 2 plus and also in HER2 3 plus. And so now this is an option in the United States, and it is FDA approved. This is a trial that is ongoing now and is randomizing patients to trastuzumab deruxtecan to a platinum-based chemotherapy with Pembro. Moving to c-MET very quickly, is important again to remember that MET can be different. We are talking now about c-MET overexpression, but you know very well that there are also MET mutations for which we have all the tyrosine kinase inhibitors already approved. And also for the MET amplifications, in particular in the United States, there is also the possibility to use MET tyrosine kinase inhibitors. I just want to go through very quickly to three casuistics that showed that MET is a negative prognostic factor, as you can see here from the Kaplan-Meier curve, is comparing c-MET low versus c-MET high. The same is again in this casuistic, and the same is again in this meta-analysis where c-MET is considered a very highly negative prognostic factor. So this is why it's so important. This new drug that is called Teliso-V was presented already 3 years ago in ASCO. This is another antibody drug conjugate targeting c-MET with, again, another cytotoxic agent and a cleavable linker. And c-MET in this trial is considered overexpression as 25% tumor cells with 3+ staining intensity or intermediate more than 25% and less than 30%. We are increasing now in our reflex testing both c-MET and HER2 because I think that all these targets must be done at diagnosis so that we can potentially see the entire possibilities for our patients. This is the Luminosity trial. You can see that the patients were enrolled with c-MET high and c-MET intermediate, and patients were highly pretreated again. And there was also a second phase of the trial that was a sort of expansion. The preliminary results that were presented 3 years ago at ASCO showed that in MET high, there is again 52.2% of response rate, again in a very highly pretreated cohort. And the results were updated at the European Lung Cancer Conference 3 months ago, and you see that they confirmed the high response rate in 59.5% of the patients. And again, you can see that both the high and the intermediate, they have a very similar response rate. So the response rate is not just for the high expressors. It's important to learn again the toxicity. The toxicity is mainly a peripheral sensor neuropathy that in 7% of cases can be severe. As in all the other drugs targeting MET, there is in 16% of the patients the common peripheral edema that we have seen also with the MET tyrosine kinase inhibitors. And again, fatigue, decrease of appetite, and increase of transaminases like we have seen with other compounds. But it's important, the peripheral sensory neuropathy. And it's important also to remember that is only in 5% of the patients there can be a keratitis. So these patients must be referred to the ophthalmologist. Moving again, this is again the side effects that were presented in the first time, and they are superimposable to the last presentation. And now the research is ongoing and is randomizing in this population of high versus negative as a stratification factor Telisotuzumab over docetaxel in the second line non-small cell lung cancer. I think I'm done. 25 seconds of before.
Perfection.
Thank you.
Perfection. All right, so I'm, yes, please. So I'm going to hit just kind of the high points on this case. But 52-year-old woman presented with a dry cough that had persisted for a year, ultimately was diagnosed with a non-small cell lung cancer, a lung adenocarcinoma, including metastases to the brain. PD-L1 was 20%, no actionable genomic alterations, and ended up starting on carboplatin, pemetrexed, and pembrolizumab. First-line therapy. That worked for about 8 months before there was progression noted in the brain. Now, I highlighted in the prior discussion that if there's a solitary site of progression, radiate that site. Well, I guess I asked the question and the panel highlighted this, but radiate that site. And I have a number of patients that do well for an extended time frame. In some cases, in the best cases, actually end up with no other therapy, and that first-line treatment can work, I mean, right now, up to who knows how long, but many years. In this case, a month later, systemic progression was noted after that brain was treated again. At that time, then, RET fusion was demonstrated, and the patient started on a phase one trial of a new drug called LOXO-292, now called selpercatinib and FDA-approved for RET fusion. This worked for a couple years before, again, multiple sites in the brain did show progression, and the patient underwent whole brain radiation. 6 months after that, ended up getting palliative radiation to the spine for systemic progression, and then started on further testing was done. In that further testing, HER2 amplification was noted. Now, the genomic testing actually did show HER2 amplification, and then IHC testing showed HER2 3+. So this patient started trastuzumab deruxtecan, in this case concurrent with selpercatinib, and got about 18 months of disease control before there was intracranial progression and particularly leptomeningeal disease. And unfortunately, some patients just, the cancer just keeps going to the brain and ends up being hard to control. So for the panel, I'm going to ask this broadly across all of you. We certainly see evidence of intracranial responses with across the deruxtecan portfolio, trastuzumab deruxtecan, patritumab deruxtecan, datopotamab deruxtecan, ifinatamab deruxtecan in the small cell space is being investigated. But have you noted any intracranial responses to trastuzumab deruxtecan, any experience with that? And then more broadly, you can speak to the portfolio if relevant. Go ahead, Solange.
Yeah. Thanks so much. Yes, I think we observe, for reasons that still remain a little biochemistry speaking, difficult to explain why these very big molecules, which are not supposed to cross any barrier, will give rise to such a nice response in the brain, but they do. So they usually give rise to a response in the brain which has a durability and a consistency quite impeccable with a systemic response. So it's probably something which we don't perfectly explain biologically. The rupture of the barrier is one thing, but it looks to be beyond that. But the efficacy is really observed there, I would say. The main thing is it immune-related? There might be here a component of the payload. It looks like the immune correlation was shown roughly a bit more with vedotin, the MMAE. But I'm not so sure about the mechanism, but the answer is yes.
Yeah. John, go ahead.
Yeah, you know, here I'll note, there's really, when we're thinking about trastuzumab deruxtecan for non-small cell, there's two different populations we're thinking about, the HER2 mutant population and then the HER2 overexpressing here where it's got a pan-tumor label. And, the HER2 mutant population, for reasons we don't fully understand, but similar to the EGFR, has an extremely high rate of brain metastases. Mm-hmm. So at the time of diagnosis in the frontline studies, we're seeing between 35 and 40% of patients have brain metastases, and we're probably excluding a number that have brain metastases from those studies. So, when I think about the HER2 mutant population, I'm always concerned about that CNS coverage. And, I think it's a group that requires, like small cell, sort of additional scrutiny. In a way, I think you can almost assume you're going to have these patients. So we're excited that there's at least some evidence of activity with trastuzumab deruxtecan, but it's clearly an important unmet need because patients do eventually have CNS progression in this group.
Yeah. Marina, yeah. Thoughts on treating for HER2 mutant and HER2 overexpression? Do you think of them similarly? What is your kind of lines of treatment for each of those?
So the number of patients for which we have data available in the HER2 overexpressing is less than the data that we have in the HER2 population. So it's very difficult from the statistical point of view to say if there is a difference or not. I think in more or less all of them, the response rate is in about 50% of cases.
And what about your standard of care? For HER2 mutant, do you go to trastuzumab deruxtecan first line, second line? And how about HER2 overexpression?
So we go with the first line. There are also the new tyrosine kinase inhibitors that are coming that are, of great interest. Maybe John can say also more about them. But we start immediately targeting HER2. And of note, I think here the patient was tested for RET not in the beginning. So again, as I said during my presentation, I think that we should organize the entire targets from the beginning so that we can have in mind all the potential treatments for the patients.
So a plug for NGS testing, this was years ago. So yeah. When the patient started, this was well before there was anything even in trials for RET. But that's the point, right?
Yeah.
Is that by doing full NGS panel testing, whatever comes along next, we now talk about KEAP1, STK11, yeah. You wouldn't really have that if you're just doing focused testing. Mm-hmm. But go ahead, John.
Yeah, and I think it's worth pointing out, and this is where it may differ than breast cancer, for example. So speaking to my, colleagues who treat breast cancer, they really think a HER2 amplified breast cancer is the driver there. Here in lung cancer, it looks like HER2 mutants are really drivers, where if you inhibit the signaling, those tumors die. But HER2 overexpressing, it isn't the same situation. When you look at the big data sets, and Shining Li recently published one, you see that HER2 amplified or overexpressing tumors have a normal tumor mutation burden. They have other drivers. So it's not the solitary driver the way it is with HER2 mutants. This may be why HER2 mutants seem to have a little better response to ADCs. You know, in DESTINY-Lung2, it was 49% versus 44% here. If you go back to T-DM1, it was a little higher for HER2 mutant, independent of the expression, as compared to the HER2 overexpressing or amplified. So I think it's useful to think about the HER2 mutant is really oncogene addicted. The HER2 amplified, it's clearly a target, but maybe not the same paradigm as with EGFR.
Excellent. Go ahead, Solange.
You made an interesting combination, right, of selpercatinib plus an ADC. It's quite interesting because to go back to the joint effort of the community, we should somehow collect these cases where, first of all, you show it works, and second, it's doable, because nobody will ever do a phase, any trial. In, I have a patient with a ROS and a RET, ROS being the second mechanism of resistance. So what are you going to do? So I think we should also at some point create some guidance, an available network of data for people to be able to make decisions which are documented in these situations, because they happen more and more with the field of targeted therapies.
Yes, yes. Okay, with that, Dr. Garasino, I think you had a case to discuss as well.
Yes, this is a patient, 64 years old, with a 40-pack year smoking history, who quit only 5 years ago and present with chest pain and dyspnea. The CT scan and the PET scan reveal a right lower lobe mass, mediastinal and hilar adenopathy, hepatic lesions concerning for metastasis. He performed a biopsy that showed adenocarcinoma with a PD-L1 more than 50%. The patient is negative for EGFR, ALK, ROS, RET, MET, all the possible targets, and is positive at the immunohistochemistry for HER2. The patient does not have brain met. So the patient started pembrolizumab single agent. The patient had an initial response, but after 12 months progressed, and based on the HER2 expression, we started trastuzumab deruxtecan. After a month, the patient developed the ILD, was treated with steroids with some benefit, but unfortunately for the steroids, he got infected and had a deterioration of his general conditions and unfortunately passed.
Okay. So trastuzumab deruxtecan, like all drugs, has some toxicities. Now, some of these to focus on. First of all, GI toxicities. Do you find that to be much of an issue? How do you manage that, if so?
I think we just give the prophylaxis to the patients. We alert the patients to take Imodium, not to eat spicy food and this kind of things. But I think we have quite a lot of experience with the gastrointestinal toxicities, while I think we are very new in the field with the ILD.
Yeah, ILD being another avenue. So the deruxtecan portfolio, we see some ILD, thankfully low numbers, but we do see wide grade. And there are some grade 5 reported, although very low numbers. The big thing, of course, is not to let it get to that point. John, when you're managing a patient on any of these drugs, but of course, including trastuzumab deruxtecan, you see some inflammatory findings on CAT scan. Of course, we see waxing and waning findings even on patients not on these. Yep. How do you decipher what might be a drug-related ILD?
Yeah, you know, this is always a clinical challenge because, of course, lung cancer patients also are prone to getting infections. They're, often have areas of obstruction. One of the ones that happens very commonly is they've received some chest radiotherapy, and then you've got fibrosis in the lung afterwards, and you're trying to interpret what's fibrosis, what's infection, and what's that ILD. So this is a real challenge to deal with clinically. One of the things I'll note is in the DESTINY-Lung2 study, they saw, with the 5.4 versus 6.4 dose, they saw a reduction in the ILD, but part of it was also selecting the right patients. So they selected patients who did not have a significant underlying COPD, who did not have significant pleural effusions. So part of this is not selecting patients who have compromised pulmonary status to begin with. In my case, I tend to be pretty aggressive at because this drug is effective and we don't have great options afterwards, at giving a shot with rechallenge. So if there is equivocal status about possible ILD that's grade one, I'll try the course of steroids to manage it. Sometimes we've got to try antibiotics if you're not sure. I will almost always rechallenge and see if it really recurs. And often things that looked like ILD in the beginning turned out to not be clinically significant. So we've had pretty good luck with rechallenge, but you have to go in with caution based on their initial pulmonary status.
Yeah, I think this is one of those areas where you want to pay a lot of attention, look for, but then don't just conclude that it is. This is like kind of holding two seemingly opposing truths. Solange.
But we have to keep in mind that if you think about immunotherapy toxicities, this is the most conservative algorithm for dose adaptation that we have across all oncology. So at grade one, the patient has no symptoms, but something on the CT scan, you discontinue. At grade two, you permanently discontinue. Right. So we are one grade down what we would do with any other compound. So we have to keep it in mind because we have been seeing, I'm also treating breast, in the early days of breast cancer, we've been seeing catastrophes.
Yeah, you know, I agree with Solange. You know, if you think of someone who's had platinum doublet with or without checkpoint already and is getting T-DXd in that setting, they don't have a long list of great options afterwards typically. So I am pretty slow to just cross it off the list there. That's why I think you really want to have the multidisciplinary team and pulmonology involved. And I discuss it with patients, but we'll often lean towards giving it another shot.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you for that nuanced discussion. Okay, we're going to go on now to TROP2 antibody-drug conjugates in advanced non-small cell lung cancer. So TROP2 in itself looks like a receptor that portends a worse prognosis. We actually don't fully understand its role, but it's thought to have a role in growth and proliferation of carcinoma cells and looks to be an oncogene. I'm going to discuss three different TROP2 ADCs, and on paper, they actually look very similar. So TROP2 antibody, hydrolyzable linker, topoisomerase inhibitor payload, you can see the DAR, or the drug-to-antibody ratio, is a little bit different. On the left, deruxtecan is a particularly potent topoisomerase inhibitor payload. So on paper, very similar. Now, the two drugs on the right there, sacituzumab govitecan and sac-TMT, I'll say for short, on the right, these are actually the same antibody. And and same drug to antibody ratio and same mechanism of payload, so particularly similar in that case. But we actually see different data when we look at more of the specifics. Now, from Dato-DXd, we saw, and this is the TROPION-Lung01, this was Dato-DXd versus docetaxel across all comers. It was those that had tumors with actionable genomic alterations and without. Now, in the non-squamous cohort, we saw particularly better results in the PFS. This was across all comers, positive progression-free survival difference, but really that was in the non-squamous cohort. See a response rate that is quite a bit more, 31% versus 13%. Now, in that, the overall survival data did not reach statistical significance in that non-squamous group. Hazard ratio is 0.84, but we saw a particular separation in the tumors with actionable genomic alterations, which was overwhelmingly EGFR. You can see a 15.6 versus 9.8-month median difference. 17% of the overall study had tumors with actionable genomic alterations. So with the low numbers, that confidence interval does still cross one. But this now sets up the discussion, okay, in the EGFR setting, it looks like is where we're seeing particularly this benefit. This was presented by Dr. Myung Juan at ESMO Asia, looking at the TROPION-Lung01 and 05 cohorts, in both cases pulling out just that EGFR mutation positive group. And so see 78 patients from TROPION-Lung05 and 39 from Lung01. Here's a chart on the left kind of showing you the baseline characteristics. On the right, you see the different EGFR mutations. Overwhelmingly, these are what we consider as classical EGFR, maybe not overwhelming, but majority classical sensitizing mutations. You can see some of those with T790M in those patients that got an initial first-generation EGFR TKI and then osimertinib third generation. And here are the results from this. So we see a response rate of 40 to 45%. median progression-free survival of 5.8 months, median overall survival of 15.6 months, median duration of response of about 7 months. And here's the toxicity profile. This is similar across studies. Stomatitis, you can see there, is the 59%. This is the majority being grade 1 stomatitis, which means it's asymptomatic, but something observed on exam. Of course, grade 2 is where that gets symptomatic. Nausea, 46%, thankfully also low grade and tended to be over days. As far as the special AEs of special interest on the bottom left, you see there stomatitis, oral mucositis within these trials. There was not, maybe we'll come to this more, but steroid mouth rinses might help. Those really weren't incorporated in these trials for the majority of the population, kind of got incorporated toward the end. Ocular surface events just feels like dry eyes, but ophthalmology evaluations were done throughout the study. And overwhelmingly, patients did fine if they had lubricating eye drops. I think there was one patient that might have had to come off treatment. And then adjudicated drug-related ILD. There was one grade 3 in this cohort. So although I mentioned that in the Dato-DXd studies, there are some patients that ended up with a grade 5 ILD, for EGFR mutant lung cancer, there was one grade 3, and that was the highest adjudicated ILD. Dato-DXd is granted priority review and is currently undergoing review with the FDA for the EGFR mutated non-small cell lung cancer after prior platinum-based targeted therapy, and platinum-based therapy is the way it was enrolled in the study. Now, sacituzumab govitecan on paper looks the same. This was a trial of docetaxel versus SASI, all-comer non-small cell lung cancer, primary endpoint being overall survival. Unfortunately, it did not meet that endpoint. You can see the median overall survival being 11.1 versus 9.8 months, hazard ratio of 0.84, a bit less in the response rate, pretty similar duration of response, progression-free survival, about a month of median overall survival, not statistically significant. There was a subgroup looked at that was pre-specified in those that had not had a response to prior immunotherapy. Now, many of the patients that got the prior line of immunotherapy also got chemotherapy with that, and so it's not just one clean subgroup necessarily, but even accounting for that, it does appear that there may be some benefit in SASI in that subgroup. I think we need more study to really try and tease that apart. As far as toxicity profile, it's quite a bit different than what we see from Dato-DXd. In this case, there was quite a bit more diarrhea. Now, similar to what we see from irinotecan, that was over some days after dose. Dato-DXd is a Q3-week dosing. This is day 1, day 8 of 21 days. But for 2-3 days, there's diarrhea, 10% being grade 3 in that SASI group. Cytopenias, you can see stomatitis substantially less than what we saw in the Dato-DXd, although still present. Overall, better tolerated from docetaxel when you look at treatment discontinuation or dose reductions or interruptions. In the interruptions, there was a bit more in the SASI group. Now, SAC-TMT, these are a few different cohorts looking at particularly EGFR mutant is what's boxed there on the top across these three different cohorts. You can see that many of these patients had gotten multiple other lines of therapy, including chemotherapy. In some cases, some patients that actually got immunotherapy as well, and also targeted treatment. Now, the top is the overall population, but you can see that when focusing on the EGFR mutant on the bottom there, we see particularly good-looking waterfall plot there. Median progression-free survival being 11.1 months. This was not without toxicities. In the red, you see that there were cytopenias. In the orange-yellow there, stomatitis was also present in this. 14% grade 3, 61% any grade, and then also some rash with this. Now, that's a focus on EGFR, but will a biomarker open this up to a bigger population? Now, the case that I presented earlier in the first-line immunotherapy discussion, he ended up going on clinical trial with Dato-DXd, did not have an actionable genomic alteration, as you may remember, got 21 months of disease control. Clearly, we do see some patients that do appear to get prolonged, durable benefit from Dato-DXd, despite the study not really showing a huge difference in those without actionable genomic alterations. We certainly still see some that benefit, and I'd say even a trend toward improvement over docetaxel in that group. But will a biomarker help us to better identify those that really benefit? Now, this was presented at World Lung. I think, Dr. Garasino, you presented this. This was looking at essentially surface-level TROP2 expression versus cytoplasmic expression. And when there was higher cytoplasm expression, particularly a cutoff of 0.56, that was considered biomarker positive if that existed in more than 75% of cells. On the right there, you see that the numbers, the percentages of the cohorts that had a positive biomarker. Now, this was developed specifically for non-actionable genomic alterations. So you see the non-squame, non-AGA, 63%. That's the cohort that this was really developed for. And Dr. Garasino presented this for progression-free survival in the TROPION-Lung01 study, which is quite compelling. Now, we do see some positivity in squamous, and we've seen some neoadjuvant data that was presented by Dr. Casconi that was pretty impressive with Dato-DXd responses. So we see some of these across. Will a biomarker help us unlock this further? A lot more to still study, but I'm hopeful for that. Now, we do have some first-line data, and we're going to hear data presented here by Dr. Ben Levy on combination Dato-DXd plus Pembro plus minus chemotherapy. You can see there were multiple cohorts previously reported out in the doublet or triplet with waterfall plots that also appear impressive as far as responses. But again, this is in the first-line setting. Response rates, though, around 50% in the triplet, and in with the doublet as well in the first line. Here's what will be presented by Dr. Levy on June 1st, so coming up. Now, there are multiple ongoing trials. The AVANZAR is DERVA with Dato-DXd and carboplatin. TROPION-Lung07 and 08 being Pembro, Dato-DXd for PD-L1 greater than less than 50% expression. EVOKE-03 is an ongoing first line with SASE, and in the squame cohort with SAC-TMT, there's a first-line trial, second-line EGFR randomized study, and then also in the first line for PD-L1 greater than 50%. So with that, we'll move on to a case presentation. And I think, Solange, was this yours?
Mm-hmm. Great. Thanks so much. So this is a difficult case of a 50-year-old never-smoker patient suffering from what we don't like to receive as a diagnosis as a mucinous adenocarcinoma, because we know how much it's difficult to find any sensitivity to the agents we have. And as you can see, a very extended one with, we call it CT4, more than 7 centimeters of tumor, largest diameter. If you try to measure it with ipsilateral lung lesions, a CN2, stage 7, and contralateral lung lesions too, so a stage 3A according to the HTNM. No biomarker, PD-L1 negative. We did large panels, nothing special, but non-actionable, I would say, alteration, KRAS G12D, a GNRAS, a RET, and a FLT3, but basically nothing which helped me to treat this patient. So basically what we decided to do, we are in May 2021, so based on what we had in hands and the biomarkers we had, we decided to go for chemo IO, carboplatin, pemetrexed, pembrolizumab, which was a kind of stabilizing the patient's symptoms and situation on the CT scan, I would say a partial response versus stable disease, but the patient went well up to the 2 years of Pembro, and we stopped at 2 years. It was mandated by his insurance. Sometimes we're better in Switzerland, but here we couldn't continue. And unfortunately, stopping in May and July, we could see a new growth and a new positivity on the PET. So after stopping IO, the lung progression was noticed. So what to do at that point? So we saw that there might be the time of adding on the top some quite close to the end of IO, a CTLA-4. So we went for ipi-nivo-carbo-paclitaxel with, as best response, a progressive disease. And we are in November 2023. So then the patient tells, let's try some more. I'm platinum resistant with all that. So let's try some more chemo. So we went with a wide combination of still ipi-nivo, but gemcitabine-vinorelbine with a partial response, showing that there was still some chemosensitivity here. Not sure about the component of immune therapy. But unfortunately, less than a year later down the road, we had this amazing progression without any doubt at the time being lymph node and lung. So we have tested a bit everything. You agree, colleagues, right? So what can we do? So we still tried some gemcitabine, docetaxel to be on the safe side of having tried everything. Patient was still of PS 0 to 1, but the best response was massive progressive disease, right? So basically what to do here. So we are now in October 2024, and we have a compassionate use access to datopotamab deruxtecan that we try in this patient as, I don't know how to say, 6 lines, 7 lines, or 8 lines of treatment with an hepatic complete response and a persistent thoracic partial response. The CT scan has never been as well as and as good as this one. Some mucositis, grade 1 to 2, the limiting factor. It's very difficult to deal with that. But at the time being, he's still 7 months after the initiation. This is the longest treatment regimen apart from the first one in this patient. So a complete response and a partial response at the lung. And the mucositis, grade 1, which might be the thing which makes the patient having the most difficult life. But quite amazing, I would say, new hope in the last line of treatment.
Yeah, it is exciting what we see from these. So, John, big question here. Yeah. Now we've had a number of EGFR mutant trial regimens that are approved or being considered. The data that we have for Dato-DXd, assuming, let's say this is now FDA approved for sake of discussion, where does this fit in?
Yeah, I think this, if approved, would be a very important new treatment modality here for these patients. Because if you think about the first-line metastatic EGFR landscape, you've really got three regimens now that are approved and commonly used. You know, putting aside the older EGFR TKIs, you've got osimertinib monotherapy. You've got FLAURA2 of osimertinib with platinum doublet. And then you've got the MARIPOSA regimen with AMI and lazertinib. So you can imagine once you've progressed, say, on FLAURA2, you know, your options are really limited. And the activity we've seen with datopotamab deruxtecan, you know, in that setting is really impressive. 40 to 45% response rate in that range for EGFR mutants. You know, historically, if we think about docetaxel, which would be an option, 10 to 14% response rate, a little bit higher if you had ramucirumab. So for me, that would clearly be a space where this could add a huge value. Now, what about if you just get osimertinib monotherapy or AMI and lazertinib, the MARIPOSA regimen? Well, there it becomes a little more debatable whether you'd use it in front of platinum doublet. The activity we're seeing is on par or a little bit higher with platinum doublet, but we don't have the direct comparison yet of this versus platinum doublet. So I would be very comfortable using it after TKI and platinum doublet, and I would absolutely consider it in patients who've progressed on either osimertinib alone or on the MARIPOSA regimen.
Excellent. Marina, I'm going to combine a couple of these. So if Dato-DXd were available, would you consider it for a patient without an actionable genomic alteration or in a patient without an EGFR mutation? Where would this, you know, if you've been through all the lines of chemo, or is there a line somewhere in there where you'd say, well, gosh, we have data for this? And then separately, don't fuse these, but separately, do you think we're going to end up using this TROP2 QCS NMR testing? Is this biomarker going to solve the answer to the first question?
I start from the biomarker because I like it most. So I think that this is not just for Dato-DXd, but is for all the antibody drug conjugates. I think we really need biomarkers because we need possibilities to sequence them. So we don't have the data yet on the overall survival of the QCS NMR. But if this is true also in the PFS and the trial is starting now using the QCS and randomizing docetaxel over Dato-DXd and also the Avanzar, I think this will be a great possibility to beat docetaxel. We always want to get rid of docetaxel, and docetaxel continues to come back like a nightmare. So I think that now we really need strategies that are biomarker driven. And clearly where to position the Dato-DXd It depends very, very much on the first line, and in particular in the EGFR, it depends when you use the chemotherapy, when you use amivantanab, and so again, I think it's really important to find who is the right population to give this drug as soon as possible.
Solange, how enthusiastic are you about these first-line combinations? We've seen some impressive data so far of immuno plus Dato-DXd. We'll see what Dr. Levy presents here. But based on what we have so far, what are your thoughts on this?
Well, the first thing which is quite important is it depends a bit on what's going to be the replacement. So we replace a carboplatin pemetrexed pembrolizumab with something which has a Dato-DXd instead of pemetrexed. So what I want to first stress is a very different toxicity profile. So we already know that it's going to be more difficult to deliver. Without being doing the trial, it's obvious. So the main thing is I'm more or less enthusiastic because I'm still not sure about the magnitude of benefit justifying the added toxicity. So I need really to see the data. We all take part because science is science. Maybe we can leverage something here. But the magnitude, the expectations we have are quite high as knowing the toxicity of the compound. What I prefer is the idea of the platinum free. A combination. So the cetuximab, triamcinolone, moving with only with pembro, because still you keep your possibility of platinum, pemetrexed, as a second line instead of docetaxel. So if you ask me about my enthusiasm, I'm running these trials, but I like the platinum free because you just free up some lines of treatment for the next steps. And about Dato, you know, we don't like Dato in non-EGFR now because we've seen the FD evolution. But we have this compassionate in Switzerland. And you can't imagine how many patients now reach third line or fourth line setting who enters a program. So we are in need of subsequent lines, right? So whatever the data show, let's keep in mind that the more lines represent probably our patient population now. It's not only two lines, they go beyond.
Yeah, yeah, excellent, excellent point. Now, I'm just going to quickly address some of the toxicities because we've addressed those some, but for the sake of time, then we can move along. Now, the oral stomatitis mucositis, this is a number of patients. Thankfully, many of them are grade 1, so asymptomatic, just to make sure we're thinking about that in the right context. Although grade 2 symptomatic stomatitis, I think, is a big deal. And if that really is persisting, then a dose reduction might be necessary, and I think that's okay. But things like steroid mouth rinses, good oral hygiene can be very important to that. Ice chips, cryotherapy essentially at the time of infusion might help some, although the half-life of the drug is long. It might also help some in just symptom relief. Sometimes also the stomatitis can improve with further lines of therapy. But again, if you need to dose reduce, dose reduce. We've seen efficacy at the 4 mg per kg dose level as well, and so I don't worry about that a ton if necessary. ILD, I think we've addressed quite a bit. Again, just highlighting the importance of look for it. Of course, it should be part of the consent. Thankfully, it's not a very high number of patients. But then also, if you see inflammatory findings, don't just conclude that that's a drug-related ILD. We see that in a lot of patients that are not getting this drug as well. And so then that really is a multidisciplinary discussion to really make sure you're considering all possible etiologies. As far as ocular adverse events, thankfully, I think this is really quite manageable with lubricating eye drops, but there's still a lot for us to learn about that, and referral to ophthalmology or even optometry, I think, is really an important step to take, especially if someone is having any symptoms. It's not immediate. If there's vision changes, if there's, you know, as the ophthalmologist would say, beefy red eye, then that would be a more need to get in urgently. Otherwise, even if it's a month, that's usually fine. Okay, with that, we'll now go on to checkpoint inhibitors in the non-metastatic setting.
Okay, well, thank you, Jacob. And I'd like to thank RTP for the chance to present here in this wonderful symposium of great materials being covered. You know, I started treating non-metastatic and non-small cell about 2 decades ago, right as the ALT study came out. And, you know, really, you didn't have to know anything beyond the ALT study for about 2 decades. Fortunately, things are different now. So I'll start off with, I think, the most important slide. You know, so today, you know, we've got at least these 6 options for non-metastatic non-small cell lung cancer. Here, specifically, the resectable group. We're going to talk about Pacific later. And so it's a wonderful thing to have choices. But of course, when you've got choices, then you've got to make choices and try to have some rational basis for making choices. So I'll talk a little bit about at least how I think about this. But we've got adjuvant studies, two of them being positive, perioperative, and then one neoadjuvant regimen. You know, I'll note something that's reassuring to me. If you look both the adjuvant and the perioperative, it's about 2,000 patients worth of experience for both of those. And, you know, what's striking is the consistency in the data, you know, that I think you can really say we've got robust signals now about the benefits, and it gives us a good roadmap to how to go forward. So let me start talking about the adjuvant studies first. So just remind everybody, it's surgery. Now, in most of these studies, they allow either neoadjuvant or adjuvant platinum chemotherapy, and then they're typically randomized to PD-1 or PD-L1, best supportive care. One thing I'll highlight as we're interpreting the results here is keep in mind the only patients going on these studies are the best quality patients in terms of making it through neoadjuvant or adjuvant therapy and surgery and having an R0 resection. So this is representing only about 2/3 of the patients that make it through all that. The neoadjuvant and the perioperative are instead taking the entire population. So you want to interpret the results in light of this is really that selected group. But we've got two approved regimens, the Empower 10 and the Keynote 91 or the PEARLS study. And I'll go through these pretty quickly. So the Empower 10 had different primary endpoints, but the approval, at least by the FDA in the U.S., is for the PD-L1 greater than 1%. And here you see a hazard ratio for disease-free survival of 0.66. So again, a 34% reduction in the likelihood of recurrence. If you take the endpoint at 2 years, and again, this is measured from the time of randomization, it's about a 13.6% improvement in two-year DFS. So clearly clinically meaningful. Keep in mind the ALT study with adjuvant chemo in this setting had about a 5% improvement at 5 years. So this is really a clear benefit. So the FDA approved this in 2022 for PD-L1 greater than 1%. Now, the Keynote 91 study was also randomized phase 3. It had multiple different populations. If you take the overall population, and it's approved here, here the hazard ratio is a little less robust at 0.76. Now, one would expect that in the PD-L1 greater than 50%, it would have a better hazard ratio. I think puzzling for me at least, and I think for many investigators, the hazard ratio is actually a bit worse in the PD-L1 greater than 50% at 0.82. So not significant there, but approved for the overall study population here. All right, so now let me move on to neoadjuvant or perioperative. And remind everybody, I've sort of divided this up into the induction phase, then surgery, and then the adjuvant phase. So the only randomized study we have of neoadjuvant therapy alone is the CheckMate 816. So that was nivolumab with platinum chemo versus platinum chemo, followed by surgery. And then we've got three approved perioperative regimens. So the 77T with the same design as 816, except on the back end in the adjuvant side, nivolumab versus best supportive care. Aegean, which was the durvalumab-based combination with a similar design, and Keynote 671, which is a similar combination with pembrolizumab. Now, to start off with CheckMate 816, the addition of nivolumab in the neoadjuvant setting clearly improved event-free survival, and later we saw overall survival. That hazard ratio has regressed a bit to about 0.68, but clearly a significant benefit, and this is only with three or four cycles of neoadjuvant therapy, so a pretty modest duration, which is the clear benefit. Now, here we show the chemotherapy arm underperformed historical standards a bit, but still a clear benefit there. If you look at 2 years, an 18.5% improvement in two-year EFS, so really a strong difference. Now, here's the 77T. Remember, similar design, except that it added a year of adjuvant nivolumab there. Here, the overall hazard ratio, 0.58. We've heard recently that overall survival was also improved here. Now, because we've got the same regimen in both the neoadjuvant and the perioperative setting, later we're going to look at these two compared a bit to see how they've come out. But this hit its primary endpoint. It hit the endpoint of improving pathologic complete response as well. Clear, meaningful benefit here at these endpoints. All right, now the KEYNOTE-671 was done with perioperative pembrolizumab. Similar design here. Here you can see the EFS hazard ratio 0.58, clinically significant. This later has hit overall survival improvement as well. And I apologize, you can't see all the subgroups, but I think the point is you'll see a broad benefit across all the different subgroups. This includes patients with who are PD-L1 negative, as well as those that are positive. It also includes patients with N2 disease. And finally, Aegean, again, achieved both its primary endpoints of pathologic complete response and event-free survival at the first planned interim analysis. Here, the overall hazard ratio is 0.68. If you take just the cisplatin group, it has the same as KEYNOTE-671 at 0.58. But a positive study, and again, benefit broadly seen, including patients with N2 disease. And I'll point out something that may be surprising to a lot of people. About 70% of this population was stage 3, so this was not a very early stage. About 50% had N2 disease. So this is a pretty advanced population. Many of these would historically be treated with the Pacific regimen. So it also achieved its endpoints. So now we've seen all those positive studies, and this leaves us the question, neoadjuvant therapy, adjuvant therapy, or both? Now, I'll tell you where I come down on this, because the stakes are so high. Here, the stake is a cure for people, and with the therapy that is relatively well tolerated. So we don't have a head-to-head comparison of these different either adjuvant, neoadjuvant, or perioperative. So we're going to have to do direct comparisons. Now, this was preclinical work led by Tina Casconi when she was in my lab, and it showed that neoadjuvant appeared to be significantly better than adjuvant therapy in mouse models, and this has been seen in other tumor types. The thought is that if you invoke an immune response when the tumor is in place, there's more neoantigens, you get a better immune response. Now, clinically in melanoma, perioperative was compared to adjuvant, and perioperative was dramatically better. Now, what do we know about in lung cancer? Well, in lung, if you take the KEYNOTE-91 and line it up against the KEYNOTE-671, and keeping in mind KEYNOTE-91 was that select population that made it through an R0 resection after adjuvant chemotherapy or neoadjuvant chemo, KEYNOTE-671 certainly appears to show an improved hazard ratio. Again, not a direct comparison. Here, Patrick Ford and Tina Casconi and the rest of the team did a comparison of 816 versus 7017, doing a patient-by-patient comparison from the time of surgery. And here they saw a clear advantage for perioperative therapy as compared to just neoadjuvant alone. Again, this isn't a randomized study. This is taking existing data and comparing it the best that they could. So the bulk of the data we have, it's indirect, but supports that perioperative seems to be better than adjuvant, and it seems to be better than neoadjuvant alone, although that's a closer call. Now, can we stratify patients or decide based on whether they have a complete pathologic response? Well, I've heard it often evoked, if a patient has a complete response and their tumor's all gone, why should they get any more therapy? Well, here this may be counterintuitive, but one important message to keep in mind, just because someone's had a pathologic complete response doesn't mean they're cured. In fact, if you look at the chemotherapy group, here, those that had a complete pathologic response still had a high rate of recurrence, you know, more than 30% if you go out to 3 years. So they're not cured, and it looks like the pembrolizumab arm did significantly better. In fact, the relative benefit in the PATH-CR group seems better than the non-PATH-CR group, but both had benefits. So this data doesn't support choosing to give immunotherapy only in the PATH-CR or the non-PATH-CR. It says both may get benefit. And after all, if that's a group that benefited the most, shouldn't they continue therapy? Now, I'm going to just briefly talk about two other regimens. So monalizumab is a drug that can help activate NK cells and CD8-positive cells by blocking an inhibitory interaction between NKG2A that happens with HLA-E. Oleclumab is a drug that blocks CD73. This is another part of the immune checkpoint. This is blocking the production of adenosine, which is immunosuppressive. So two completely different mechanisms. So Tina Casconi has led NeoCOAST-2. This is taking the Aegean regimen and building on it with these other additional regimens. And if you take these first two arms, it seems like there is at least some improvement in pathologic complete response, more impressive with monalizumab. But the most impressive improvement in pathologic complete response is seen with Dato-DXd, and this is a study that Jacob had mentioned. Now, finally, where else could this be applied? Well, keep in mind for unresectable patients that we have the Pacific regimen with adjuvant durvalumab for a year. And you know, updated data is really held strong for the long-term benefits there. With the 14% improvement in five-year PFS and a 10% improvement in five-year OS. So we're getting more cures with this regimen, almost doubling the percentage of people that are cured. COAST is a regimen taking that Pacific regimen and building on it with monalizumab and oleclumab. And the early data looks good, although there are concerns the control arm may be underperforming here. So finally, let me try to summarize all this data. Here you've got both for stage three patients, perioperative data looks important, as does the Pacific. Here's the MDT bridge that tries to say, do we have to decide early on or can we start with chemoimmunotherapy, make a decision at that point whether they may be resectable? So I think this is an interesting possibility. So let me just talk about the paradigm then. For resectable, we have neoadjuvant, adjuvant, or perioperative. I believe the bulk of the data supports perioperative thus far. For unresectable, we've got right now the Pacific regimen, or if it's node negative, SBRT remains an option. And we have this emerging group of borderline patients where there's different ways to consider either perioperative or the Pacific regimen. And you know, we're looking forward to further studies exploring that because we think it may be a larger group of patients that could benefit from resection. So with that, I'll stop and look forward to the cases.
Great. We're going to jump straight to questions. I'm struck by a line in the movie The Matrix, time is always against us. We have so much to discuss. It's been exciting. But we are very limited on time. So, John, I'm going to ask you one question and kind of clump a few things in there. You've highlighted really the likely benefit of neoadjuvant, or certainly made that case. Now, we have seen from these studies that in stage two, maybe the benefit doesn't appear as big in adding neoadjuvant immunotherapy. There can be a delayed time to starting treatment with the genomic testing that's required up front and such. So there are complexities to this in actual practice. Are there subgroups or subpopulations where you feel more strongly than others as far as the importance of neoadjuvant therapy versus allowing for maybe adjuvant therapy or evaluation after surgical resection? And on top of that, or kind of baked in, in practice it starts becoming, well, is this surgically resectable? Let's see about the response. I mean, what do you think is the validity in that?
Yeah, I think those are all great questions. So first of all, part of the obstacle to this is it requires to neoadjuvant therapy or perioperative is it requires a little bit of a different paradigm. I think for a long time, the paradigm in places I practice at least was see a surgeon, cut it out, see a medical oncologist, think about things afterwards. But for us to incorporate neoadjuvant therapy, you need molecular profiling. You need to make sure they're not EGFR or ALK positive. And that is delays. And it's easy to convince people, hey, just get it cut out now while you're waiting. So I think overcoming that obstacle and making sure we've got true multidisciplinary teams working effectively together is one important point. Secondly, I think there's probably going to be less benefit for neoadjuvant chemoimmunotherapy in patients who have drivers. Now, these studies excluded or excluded at least known EGFR or ALK, but we've got a lot of other drivers that don't benefit much from immunotherapy. You gave the example of a RET fusion patient, right? So that's one where I would have caution there. Patients where I feel especially strongly are those that are borderline or have N2 nodal disease, right? Because that's a group, the rates of clearing N2 nodal disease is pretty high with these regimens. So I think the benefit is particularly strong for more advanced patients who don't have driver alterations.
Well, we got a number of questions that were submitted, and unfortunately, we don't have the time, but please find me during the conference. Email me. My email is available out there. I'm very happy to engage further on this. I look forward to discussing this more with all of you and would like to thank the panel members. Thank you so much for so much input on this. On behalf of the panel and myself, thank you all for your attendance. Thank you, Neil Love and team, for coordinating everything and for the sponsors as well. Thank you so much. Have a great ASCO.